Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a White House in chaos, with a torrent of leaks fanning the flames of intramural fighting amongst top officials, blaming each other for the dysfunction. David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, joins us to discuss his latest article, Who Will Be the First Victim of White House Chaos?, and the tenuous fates of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who appears to have lied to the Vice President, Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who has been mercilessly lampooned by Melissa McCarthy, Reince Priebus, who is increasingly isolated from Trump's inner circle, and Kellyanne Conway, who has managed to provoke the slavishly friendly Republican Congress into questioning her ethics. We will look into how the real world is colliding with reality TV inside the White House as it emerges that Trump is running the U.S. government like The Apprentice in what is becoming Survivor, the West Wing. Then we'll look further into the fate of General Michael Flynn, who Press Secretary Sean Spicer said today is being evaluated by Donald Trump. William Danvers, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as a special assistant to President Clinton for national security affairs and worked for Leon Panetta at the CIA and the Pentagon in the Obama administration, joins us. We will discuss the extent to which the knives are out in the White House in a state of turmoil that could soon be thrown into even more chaos. Then finally, Rodrigue Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal, who was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, joins us to examine the discussions that took place today in the White House between Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Trump, as well as the Women's Business Forum that Trump's daughter Ivanka presided over to set up a cross-border council to advance women into executive positions and encourage entrepreneurship. And joining us now is David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and has an article at The Atlantic, Who Will Be the First Victim of White House Chaos? Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you for having me.
And when you talk about White House chaos, of course, there is a possibility that the chaos is deliberate. That is one of the explanations that Donald Trump has brought the techniques of The Apprentice to the White House, where you pit various contestants against each other, have encouraged treachery, all kinds of chicanery and outrageous behavior, and then whoever the last man or woman standing is wins the day. So is there an element of that going on here as the knives are being sharpened in the West Wing?
Well, certainly you have two competing teams. There's a kind of establishment team and there's an insurgent team, and they can be playing off each other and leaking about each other and jockeying for position and seeing who can topple somebody first. So I think that tension is certainly part of the design. And, you know, I think every president gets the White House that he wants, and this is perhaps what Trump wants. Now, whether that achieves the goals he wants in the long term is a question we have to wait and see.
Well, but at this point, so many of the top people are vulnerable. There's no question about the vulnerability of Michael Flynn, General Flynn, who pretty clearly lied to the vice president, and the vice president being a very religious man, that's a Ten Commandment that was broken. He's thou shalt not bear false witness. So I suspect that's put Flynn in a very tenuous position. My understanding is that Sean Spicer, who of course has been mercilessly lampooned by Melissa McCarthy, apparently Trump is not happy about the way he looks, and he's very apparently, appearances are extremely important to him. Reince Priebus apparently is increasingly isolated from the inner circle, which is largely, it consists, I believe, of Stephen Bannon and Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner. And then on top of that, as you point out in your article, David Graham, that even Kellyanne Conway, who's the best spokesman he's got, she managed to step on her own propaganda, and now that you've got this usually supine Republican Congress questioning her ethics.
Yeah, that's really the interesting case to me. You know, the other folks are in danger because Trump is displeased with the way they're working, but there's also reasons to hold each of them around. Conway is the interesting case because, one, she doesn't seem to clearly be on either the establishment team or the insurgent team. She's sort of in the middle. But also, the person she's in trouble with is not Trump, but Congress, which, you know, could try to force her to be censured or punished in some way. So it's the outside pressure that seems to make that case unusual. And it's surprising to see the Republican Congress actually being concerned about this. Of all the things that might have aroused their ire, that it would be this product endorsement that she offered for Ivanka Trump's clothing is a little bit surreal.
But where's the loyalty, though? When you talk about the establishments versus the insurgents, who are the establishments? Because, you know, Kellyanne Conway, Bannon, they all came from Ted Cruz's campaign, did they not?
I'm not sure about Bannon, but certainly Conway has been around a lot of places and came from those places. Mm-hmm. I think the establishment team is basically Priebus, who grew closer and closer to Trump over the course of the campaign from the RNC, and then Sean Spicer, who he brought in from the RNC. Spicer, of course, is another one of these embattled folks. You have the cabinet officials who seem like maybe they're more in line with the establishment, but they also seem like they're quite marginalized.
Well, my understanding is that a lot of these people are leaking. I mean, one of the accusations against General Flynn is that he leaked the 3 a.m. phone call that he got from Trump asking him about what do you do about a strong dollar and the economic consequences of that, which is not necessarily the National Security Advisor's strongest suit. you know, and then the leaks. Who was behind the leaks about to Glenn Thrush at the New York Times about Trump stumbling about at night in his bathrobe, not knowing where the light switches are, in the family quarters and watching TV all night and tweeting like mad at 3 a.m. when he gets mad at what was said about him on cable TV. Who's leaking all that? They have to be high-level leaks.
You know, it's hard to tell in any given case exactly who the leak is. And, you know, I wouldn't know exactly who Thrush is talking to, but it seems like everyone is leaking. And you can see, you know, I think you can look at where they come from. If the leaks are targeting Spicer, one can guess with some confidence they're probably coming from the sort of Bannon wing of people who are skeptical of Spicer and think that he's kind of a little bit weak and not cut out for the job and maybe not a real Trump person. If the leaks are targeting Bannon and Miller, the guess is they're coming from the Priebus wing, which thinks those guys are radicals and have to be reined in. When they target Trump, I mean, you wonder exactly what the thought is. There doesn't seem to be the kind of loyalty you get in previous White Houses. People will leak about their own enemies inside the White House, but for them to leak this kind of damaging stuff about the president at this early stage is pretty unusual.
Is it possible, and I've heard this from a number of people who've known Trump over the years, that he's not a very pleasant person? He's not an easy person to be around? That he's kind of crazy, to put it mildly.
I think a lot of people have said that over the years, and I think that some of these leaks are so far-fetched that, you know, you wonder how much to believe. But the ones about him being sort of irritable and upset about things and a little bit mercurial match with everything that we know about his business career up to now, and so they tend to jive with reality, and that makes them seem fairly credible.
And again, I'm speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He was previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Who Will Be the First Victim of White House Chaos? So if this is going to happen, for example, we've mentioned a few people that are on shaky grounds, Priebus, and these are extremely high-level positions. The Chief of Staff, National Security Advisor, Flynn, of course, is the one. Again, today, Sean Spicer said that they were sort of, he's being evaluated by the president. That is not exactly a ringing endorsement, is it?
No, and it's, there's no single line on it either. I mean, you have Flynn saying, you have Spicer saying that Flynn is being evaluated. You have Kellyanne Conway saying that he has the full confidence of the president. You had Stephen Miller on TV yesterday saying he couldn't say and refusing to stick up for him. So there's not even a consistent party line on what Flynn's how tenuous Flynn's position is, which speaks, I think, to the disunity and struggle with message control that these folks have.
But given this, how, you know, I can't imagine Trump could lose Kellyanne Conway, because she really is the best asset that he has in terms of being able to sort of basically I don't know, steamroll of the press into believing that there's actually some alternative rally out there that's credible. I mean, she's amazing how she lavishes lipstick on this pig, you know, to quote a Sarah Palin quote. So, but if Flynn goes, that's a huge hole in this operation. And if the Priebus goes, and if the white, I guess the press guy is a little more replaceable. But if you already have a White House in chaos, getting rid of all these key people, or some of them, or even one of them, is going to add to further chaos, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I think maybe Flynn is the most expendable from that perspective. People have been skeptical of his ability to run the National Security Council since the start, and you know, there are leaks about him as well, saying he, you know, he's not running a very tight ship, and he, you know, there's just mismanagement, and that's one reason Stephen Bannon felt compelled to try to take a spot on the National Security Council. So, in some ways, it might actually be an improvement to the administration to toss out Flynn, who seems to be a little bit of a liability, and to freak out the Secretary of Defense and some others. But removing somebody in a high level at this early stage does throw things into chaos. They're still trying to get on their feet, and it would, you know, put them back on the drawing board on National Security Advisor, for example.
So then could you surmise that it was Bannon who's been leaking this damaging stuff about Flynn, and how Trump himself is angry at Flynn, and how he's angry at Flynn over his son's tweets saying that Hillary Clinton was running a sex slave ring out of a pizza parlor in Georgetown?
You know, it's possible, although Bannon and Flynn have historically been fairly close. You know, Flynn was very sympathetic to the kind of Breitbart mindset, the wild-eyed anti-Islam view that they espoused. And so, he seems like a natural fit and to have come from those people. You know, that said, once you get into the White House and you're trying to work together, sometimes new tensions emerge.
Well, but hasn't Flynn spent more FaceTime with Trump? Perhaps, although perhaps Bannon has spent more FaceTime. I'm not sure. Who would know? But he's certainly spent a lot of time with him, hasn't he? So surely have they established some kind of rapport, some kind of chemistry?
Yeah, I think Trump is a big fan of Flynn's. You know, he kept him around all through the campaign, despite some serious criticism. He kept him around after the Pizzagate scandal. He kept him around despite these various criticisms. And Trump seems to have a real genuine respect for people who served in uniform, whether that's born out of his own not serving or something else. There's something about generals that really draws them to Trump, and I think he likes the kind of toughness that Flynn projects.
Well, what's he going to do, though, if he's got a couple of other generals there, and it looks as though it's the vice president that's basically, if it happens, it'll be Pence who just basically says, you know, there's no going back. I can't work with people who lie to me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who he might tap for that job instead. You could imagine somebody like, say, John Bolton, who has been floated for other jobs but has not landed in any of them, ending up as the National Security Advisor. He's somebody who has some of the same radical views as Flynn, but is not, maybe is a little bit more tactful about what he says publicly.
So is this a case of be careful what you wish for? I mean, Bolton is way out there in loony land, and the only person worse would be Frank Gaffney.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to imagine these are the kind of people who fit with the Trump worldview and who have been advising him. So if Flynn goes, I would think those people would show up at least on the short list.
So when do you think that the dust will settle, or is this just Survivor West Wing, as you mentioned in your article, and that stay tuned for the next episode?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be curious to see if and when Trump does fire anybody. But whether or not he does, you know, I've been speaking to some veterans of the early Clinton administration, which is a little bit chaotic, although nothing like this. And that took months for them maybe even a year for them to really smooth things out. And if this is a more chaotic administration with less experience in government, you'd imagine it would take even longer for them to get it straight.
And do you think that at the end of the day, the vice president is going to come out stronger? Because a lot of people think that, you know, he's sort of, in effect, running the show. As we know, Trump's son offered the vice presidency to the Ohio governor, John Kasich, who was running against him during the campaign. And apparently in that conversation, he was told, you'll have the domestic portfolios and you also have the foreign policy portfolios, at which point the governor's representative said, wait a minute, what's the president going to do? What's Donald Trump going to do? And the answer was, he's going to make America great again. So, so the assumption is that the vice president has inordinate powers to begin with, and he seems to be running certainly the House and Senate side of things, if not, you know, trying to make some sense out of this chaotic executive branch.
Well, I think your point about Flynn having apparently lied to Pence is really the key. If Flynn survives despite that, it would seem to me to suggest that Pence doesn't have really a lot of sway if he couldn't, you know, to be allowed to go out and pass along this lie, and then for Flynn to survive would suggest some weakness on his part. On the other hand, if Flynn does go, it would suggest his influence and would show, really, I think, that Pence is a major power player in the administration.
Well, David Graham, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and has an article at The Atlantic, Who Will Be the First Victim of White House Chaos? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking further into the fate of General Michael Flynn.
After all, he's just a man. Stand by your man. Give him two arms, a traitor, and something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Danvers, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who's worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and in various international organizations. He served in the Clinton administration as special assistant to the president for national security affairs and as senior director for legislative affairs at the National Security Council. And in the Obama administration, he worked for Leon Panetta at the CIA and at the Pentagon. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Danvers.
Thank you very much for having me.
And our previous guest was saying the White House has sort of run a bit like the reality TV show The Apprentice, where everybody is sort of pitted against each other in the survival of the fittest, with the big dog coming in and settling everything. But it's of late, it's looking more and more like Survivor, the West Wing.
I think that, certainly from where I sit, that's a fairly accurate description. There's a lot of chaos, and clearly when you take on the press, you've always got to be careful, because what gets reported, I think, I'm sure is accurate for the most part, but it's also not necessarily complimentary, because if you're constantly beating the press, they may not be quite as inclined to see all the great things that are going on. Although in this case, maybe there are not a lot of great things going on. In terms of the national security apparatus at the White House, I mean, General Flynn seems to be under some duress, in part because of what he did before President Trump took office, with having the conversation with Ambassador Kislyak and talking about, I guess, sanctions, and that seems to be confirmed. So that's obviously a problem. But I think even more of a problem in General Flynn's case is the fact that he may have lied to the vice president, and that is one of those things that I think you just simply can't do. So we'll see how that plays out. In terms of how the place is running, it seems to be a little chaotic. There don't seem to be as many people there who need to kind of run things at the moment.
On the other hand, it takes a little time for a White House to set itself up, and I remember our National Security Council at the beginning of the Clinton administration took a little time, but we had two very capable people who sort of understood how things needed to work, and in Tony Lake and Sandy Berger, and that really helped things along. I'm not sure you have that same sort of capacity at this White House. I'm not sure that you have people who kind of get how government needs to function and work, and that may be part of the problem as well.
But if Flynn is given the boot, then that will automatically make it more chaotic, won't it?
Well, not necessarily. If you get someone else in who is more organized and who still has the president's ear and who can run things a little bit better, then it could actually be an improvement. I really don't know. It just depends on who they put in place. One of my pet theories is that good management is highly underrated. Everybody's got great ideas in Washington, and everybody's got great theories, and you've got a lot of smart people, particularly in the area of national security. But good management is really, really hard to come by. And if you don't manage a place well, then you can have all the great ideas in the world and all the smartest people surrounding you, but you're not going to be able to implement and carry things forward. And I think that's something that needs to be focused on, particularly at this National Security Council, but also this White House, because they've had a very, very rocky start.
Well, there are rumors that maybe General Petraeus will come in, but he's already been auditioned, from what I understand. And I would find it pretty extraordinary to think that Petraeus would be working with Katie McFarland, who in the infamous audio tape when he was in Afghanistan running the war, Katie McFarland, as an emissary of Roger Ailes, came over there to try and get Petraeus to run against President Obama. And he turned her down, but clearly the tape itself might well have come from him. That would be the assumption. So what's your sense of that? That was an exercise in massive hubris. I've never heard anything like that. I don't know whether you've heard the tape. But
no, I hadn't heard the tape.
Woodward
massive hubris on whose part, though?
On the part of the Fox people, that they yeah. were kingmakers. You know, in other words, you get to, you know, don't take the CIA job, don't take the Joint Chiefs jobs. Roger's going to run the campaign. Rupert's going to pay for it. I mean, it's an amazing. Bob Woodward surfaced it.
Yeah, I hadn't heard the tape, although clearly Roger Ailes and his people never read the Iliad. Had they, maybe they would have understood that hubris is not one of those vices you want to have, because it will bring you down. In the case of in the situation of General Petraeus, I had the opportunity to work with him a little when I was at the agency and Leon Panetta was leaving and he was coming in, and was very impressed by him. He's clearly a very smart man, was very impressed by the fact that he wanted good management. He had those four stars for a reason. He was a very good manager. And I think if someone like that were to come into the National Security Council as the National Security Advisor, it would probably make a big difference. I think politics in Washington is a lot like politics anywhere. Things happen. People sort of get mad or get upset at the moment, or embrace someone at the moment, and then move on. And I'm sure that he could work with KT McFarland if he thought he wanted to do the job and wanted to work for this administration in this White House. I'd be slightly surprised if he would take the job, because it's not the same as being Secretary of State, and he's already, I mean, he was the head of CENTCOM. He ran our operations in Afghanistan. He was the head of the CIA. So to go to the White House essentially as the president's staffer is maybe not something I would have thought he wanted to do. But who knows? He's a patriot and a good man, and I don't think that would be a bad move at all. I think it could actually be quite helpful.
And again, I'm speaking with William Danvers, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who's worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and in the various international organizations. He served in the Clinton administration as special assistant to the president for national security affairs and a senior director for legislative affairs at the National Security Council. And in the Obama administration, he worked for Leon Panetta at the CIA and at the Pentagon. But just given what happened with Hillary Clinton, and particularly with this cloud hanging over the legitimacy of Donald Trump's presidency, questions about the extent of Russian involvement, which the intelligence community unanimously agree happened, the degree to which it happened and the degree to which Trump was involved is yet to surface. He, for some reason or other, does not want to clear the air about his own legitimacy, which leads you to be question it. But in general, what I find deeply ironic is that the entire Trump campaign was focused largely on Hillary Clinton's email server and that she was not a good steward of national security because somehow she let all these secrets loose. And that was the kind of dressing down that she got from the FBI director along those lines, even though he declined to prosecute her. And that whole thing was such a storm in a teacup. What General Flynn has done is really reckless. And not, you know, it's not imaginary. This is real from what we know even to this point. And the fact that he didn't even seem to know that the NSA was monitoring phone calls in and out of the Russian embassy is breathtaking.
Well, particularly since he's an intel man, and actually apparently a pretty good intel man when he was in Afghanistan in Iraq. I quite agree in that. I think that the consternation over Hillary Clinton's emails was a tempest in a teapot. I never really thought there was much there that needed to be blown so out of proportion, which I think it was, and I think it was detrimental to her, and it bothered me a great deal. I think you're right. What General Flynn did was certainly not appropriate, and he needed to be called. He needs to be called on the carpet for it, and I think that should happen. But he, as I said a moment ago, even more egregious would be lying to the vice president, which I think is something that no one can get away with, no matter who they are, what party they belong to, or who the president or vice president is. You simply can't do that because that undercuts his ability to get the job done, and the vice president is obviously crucial to the running of the White House and the running of the government. So I think that's a big problem. In terms of what happens next with this team, as I mentioned, I think it depends on who they bring in. Someone like Petraeus would be good, but I hope there's some lessons learned as well, that you can't get away with trying to sort of sweep things aside and be imperious in how you handle these issues and how you handle relationships, whether it be with allies or with Capitol Hill. There was, I forget what the fellow's name was yesterday, Miller, I think. And it was a very interesting performance. I've never really seen anything quite like it. Particularly his attacks on the judiciary, I thought were really, really unprecedented. I mean, even worse than anything that the president had said. And I don't think that's the kind of face that you want to put on your national security team going forward. I just think it's not good for anybody.
Well, but Stephen Miller is joining the ranks of Kellyanne Conway, and I believe that the kind of eminence gris, Stephen Bannon, is very much the power behind the scenes here. And what I find frightening about the Trump people, and particularly their peculiar bromance with Putin, you know, I spent a lot of time in arms control in the Soviet Union, and I know, you know, obviously they ran on propaganda. They didn't have the news. They had propaganda. In fact, recently Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, addressed all of the top media people in China and reminded them that their job was propaganda, not news. So when we talk about fake news, what we're really talking about is propaganda. So if you have propagandists here in the United States creating a reality amongst their own followers, and, you know, let's assume there's about 40% of America follows Donald Trump, that's a scary alternative reality. And what I saw with Stephen Miller when he was going on about busloads of voters coming from Massachusetts into New Hampshire without providing any evidence, again, that plays well with his own people, but it's a scary, slippery slope into the United States starting to practice propaganda at the state level.
I could not agree with you more. And in some ways, I think that is a much bigger problem than anything else we're facing, because there will be a legacy attached to that. Because if this group can get away with it, other groups may try. I also think it was the biggest problem with the Russians during the election was the disinformation, which is a word, but going back to the Soviet era, it's a Russian word, disinformation. And I think that is something we really need to be diligent about. And this whole attack of the press, which I began the conversation with, I think is obviously not good for anyone, because the press is what basically keeps us, a bit away from the kind of bad government that none of us want, the kind of government that I think was being described yesterday on a lot of the shows, where the president is supreme and everybody else has to fall into line. Alternative facts, disinformation, propaganda just is not the way to run a government. It's not something we should tolerate in our leaders, particularly people in the White House.
So do you think that given that he's not only attacked the press, and that Stephen Bannon made it pretty clear when he said that the press are the main opposition, mm-hmm. which he sort of downplays the Democratic Party and more or less says that this is our enemy, the press. And, of course, the role of the press is to provide information to the public, and they are the only people that can keep this administration accountable. So if you're cynical, you think, well, yeah, that's what they're going after, the people that could actually hold them accountable. I get that. But at the same time, you have this propaganda apparatus going on, but at the same time, they've also, in effect, attacked the intelligence community at large. And I'm wondering whether there could be some blowback in that regard, because there's certainly Senator Burr is slow walking the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into the Russian involvement or alleged Russian involvement in the election and vis-a-vis the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. And there's some talk of having an independent counsel. Nancy Pelosi's called for it, but I don't think the Republicans are interested. They put political people at the CIA and at the DNI. Do you think that that is a battleground that's shaping up there, an effort to both, on the one hand, to cover up what might be a smoking gun in terms of the Russian connection, and on the other hand, an intelligence community that's kind of irritated by the attacks on their professionalism?
I think the only way we'll know if there's a smoking gun is if we have this investigation. The Center for American Progress is very supportive of this whole idea of a commission, and you have legislation that was introduced in the House by Representative Cummings and others, and then you had legislation introduced in the Senate by really some very senior senators, Senator Cardin, Senator Leahy, Senator Feinstein, Senator Carper, Senator Klobuchar, who all want a commission, a 9/11-like commission. If there's nothing to hide, there's nothing to be fearful about having a commission like this. And this isn't simply about Donald Trump. This is about figuring out what the Russians did, why they did it, how they did it, what we can do to prevent it from happening again. We're very supportive of that. In fact, tomorrow, Senator Cardin is coming to the Center for American Progress to give a speech, and I'm sure he will address the whole idea of having a commission. A few weeks ago, we had Senator Durbin and Congressman Schiff, who talked about the need to continue this drumbeat, about to find out exactly what happened. And if there are connections between Trump advisors, Trump campaign advisors, and what occurred, then we need to know that. And if there aren't, we need to know that as well. So I think you hit the nail on the head. We have to keep a drumbeat on this. And I think the press has to keep it going, and we've got to keep it going. And at some point, maybe the administration will understand that this is in our national interest. This is an American issue, not a Donald Trump issue. Don't forget, it took a year before the Bush administration finally said, okay, we want a 9/11 commission, and that was highly successful, the 9/11 commission. So it may take some time to get there, but I think we need to continue to push to see that it does.
So back to General Flynn and the tenuous position he appears to be in. What is going on, though, with this torrent of leaks coming out of the White House from the most senior levels, including, for example, the phone call with the Australian Prime Minister? The White House transcripts were sanitized, apparently, by Stephen Bannon, and somebody there let the world know via the Washington Post what really went on in that conversation, which I think is important, obviously. But in general, what's going on there? Because, for example, in Flynn's case, he must have been the source of that phone call that he got at 3 a.m. from Donald Trump, waking him up to ask him about what we can do about a strong dollar, an economic question that Flynn was not necessarily equipped to answer.
The leaks fascinate me. Every administration leaks some, and so that's not surprising. But the amount of leaks and those kinds of leaks happening at the very beginning of the administration, usually people become disgruntled over time and saying, "Oh my God, no one's paying attention to me, so I'll get some attention this way." But I think people are very nervous about the way things are going within the administration, and I think that's the rationale for the leaks. I think that they want to call attention to some things that are problematic. And for instance, let's use the phone call with the Australian PM. I mean, I think part of that was not simply to embarrass, but part of that was for people to understand, you need to know that this is going on, that this is what's happening, and this is concerning to us. I mean, Australia is one of our best allies. I mean, it was a silly thing to do. It was a Bush League thing to do. And I think that what people were concerned about, the people who leaked it clearly, was they wanted the media to know, they wanted the Hill to know, they wanted the American people to know that this is occurring, and that it's something that we all ought to be concerned about.
Well, just in closing then, do you think that there's a chance that this could be less chaotic if you get an adult in the room there? I mean, it's bad enough to having a president who is, to put it charitably, is a non-politician, but you do need adult supervision, particularly at that key position of being the National Security Advisor.
I think you do. I think you absolutely do. But I will say this, it really all begins and ends with the president. And the president sets the tone. And I happen to work in a White House where you had a very good and thoughtful president, worked in an administration where you had a good and thoughtful president. And this isn't a Democratic issue. I mean, people like George H.W. Bush and later on even George W. Bush, I think, sort of got it and understood the importance of management and understood that the ultimate responsibility of running the government and making sure that the nation was safe and developing a good, solid national security strategy was up to him. And I think that the president, it is ultimately up to the president. And I think having a good person as your national security advisor is important, but it's not dispositive.
Well, William Danzitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with William Danvers, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who has worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and in various international organizations. He served in the Clinton administration as special assistant to the president for national security affairs and as senior director for legislative affairs at the National Security Council. And in the Obama administration, he worked for Leon Panetta at the CIA and at the Pentagon. We can take a brief station break. We're back examining the discussions that took place today in the White House between Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. His books include The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roderick Tremblay.
Thank you very much.
And what did you make of the meeting today in the White House where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada met with Donald Trump? They were very sort of, big hugs and handshakes. And obviously, there's hanging over it is the treatment of the Australian Prime Minister by Donald Trump. So I think his aide probably told him to be trying to be nice to our neighbor next door. And of course, in the course of the photo opportunity for the press, Justin Trudeau made it clear that he won't lecture Donald Trump over refugee bans. So he dodged all those questions. And of course, Trump himself dodged questions about Michael Flynn. So bit of a non-event. So what happened in private, do you think?
Well, it was not a non-event. I think it seems to have gone very well. Mind you, the Canada and the United States are the two largest trading partners in the world. There are no countries that trade with each other as much as Canada and the United States. We are talking about $700 billion every year. And we have jobs, a lot of jobs on either side, on both sides, that depend on these trade. flows. In the case of Canada, which has an open economy and very trading economy, it's about a quarter of our GDP, gross national product, that depends on trade. And in the U.S., you know, the people may not be aware of that, but some 9 million jobs, American jobs, depend on American exports to Canada in chemical products, appliances, telecommunications, military planes, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of stake between Canada and the United States, and leaders should not upset the apple cart and create problems for both countries, for companies in both countries.
Well, indeed, Canada's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, said that the combination of Canada being smaller and the United States being bigger and the relationship largely being trouble-free means a lot of Americans don't spend a lot of time thinking about Canada. Americans are not always fully aware of the economic significance of the relationship. So you've just made a case that basically supports what she said. I take it, though, she, you know, I used to interview her when she was here in the United States as a journalist. She believe in the foreign ministry in Canada, they've set up a new division for the United States for the first time, have they not, under the Trump administration?
That's a bit late. This should have been done 30 years ago because, you know, it's in 1988, nearly 30 years ago, that President Ronald Reagan and Prime Minister Brian Mulroney signed the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. It's only a few years later when the Bill Clinton administration included Mexico in that deal, in that agreement, and that became the North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So this has been going on for 30 years. The trade, you know, commercial trade between Canada and the U.S. are about equalize each year, roughly $350 billion each way. And American companies are very present in Canada. They have something like $400 billion of investments. That goes, of course, from the big car manufacturers, but you have Costco, you have Home Depot, you have a lot of Canadian American companies in Canada, and there are Canadian companies in the U.S. also. So I wrote an article a few weeks ago saying, when it's not broken, don't fix it. There are other problems in the world than the question of trade between the United States. That doesn't mean that both governments should not review the existing agreement and correct some irritants. I know that the U.S. has some demands on that, and the Canadian government will have some demands on that. But I think this should be done on a friendly matter and not on a hostile, with an hostile approach.
And again, I'm speaking with Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. And his books include The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. So since you were involved with NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, and Donald Trump ran against NAFTA and the TPP. He's already pulled out of the TPP. He's threatening to build a wall on the Mexican border. No such threats on the Canadian border. But what do you think is going to happen? Is he going to be good to his word? And if he does pull out of NAFTA, does that mean that the bilateral U.S.-Canadian agreement then comes into play?
That's a very tough question. As of now, of course, Canada should build maybe a wall between Canada and the United States, because I read an article that many immigrants in the U.S. now are trying to cross the border illegally to Canada. In 1994, when the Bill Clinton administration included Mexico in the bilateral trade between Canada and the U.S., I was not in favor of that. Because Mexico is a low-wage country. You know, Canada and the U.S. have about the same standard of living and the same wage and the same labor laws and all that. And when Mexico was involved in that three-partite agreement, it brought to the table a lot of special problems for the United States. You mentioned immigration. Of course, there's a lot of frictions between the United States and Mexico on immigration. And also the question of offshoring of American jobs to Mexico because it's the wages are so much lower, sometimes a third of what they are in the U.S., has created some real problem. Because when labor and workers are not mobile, as they are, if your companies are mobile, they can move everywhere, anywhere they go to get the cheap labor, that creates resentment among the labor movement and among workers and among regions. And that played a big role in the election of Mr. Trump because states like Michigan, what we call the Rust Belt, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and all these states, may have suffered by the offshoring of American jobs to low-wage countries. And this will have to be discussed between the United States and Mexico to see if some remedies or some procedures could be set up to prevent that. Mind you, a lot of American companies are international companies. For example, a car manufacturing may manufacture its engine in the United States. Its transmissions can be built in Europe, and the assembly can be done in Mexico. This is difficult to this is a difficult problem to solve because you don't want to upset the functioning of all your corporation, all your international corporations, because everybody would be losers if this were the case. So they need to be some cooler heads in the Washington D.C. to analyze these problems with specific approach, and I'm sure they could find some sort of solution and prevent damage being done to all the economies concerned.
Well, of course, so much of the immigration argument was brought up by Donald Trump in the campaign, not the economic side of it so much, but just the in terms of sort of stirring up a lot of white resentment, particularly amongst the white working class, which it clearly did pay off for him in those Rust Belt states. And many people here in the United States make the comparison between the hostile anti-immigrant rhetoric of Donald Trump, both in the campaign and subsequently in the White House, and the more compassionate approach that Canada has taken, particularly to refugees from Syria. So what's your take on that?
Well, Canada doesn't have the same problem as the U.S. Regarding, of course, illegal immigration. Most of immigration to Canada is legal immigration. And even the refugees, the acceptance of refugees is being done on a legal basis. Of course, there's a debate in the U.S., in Canada also, that we are accepting maybe too many refugees for our population, and this could create some social problem in the years ahead, a bit like in Europe, you know, in Germany or in France or in Great Britain. Brexit was mainly caused by the fear of too many refugees coming from the Middle East. And speaking of the Middle East, of course, the refugees have been created by the wars that have been going on for 15 years in that part of the world. And that's another problem that should be solved because they are all related.
Well, the other criticism that Donald Trump has had of neighbors and allies has been in terms of defense spending. He feels that a lot of the NATO allies are freeloaders and they need to spend more. And I don't know he's ever specifically mentioned Canada, but do you think that went on in the discussions, that Canada should spend more on defense?
Well, it depends depends on the way the Trump administration addresses the question of world affairs. If the United States wants to be the leader of NATO and they want to use NATO as an instrument for intervention around the world, of course, people who don't have countries that which don't have the same interests are not anxious to spend money to aggress other countries. If it is to have self-defense, of course, countries should spend all the money that is necessary to be self-defense. In the case of Canada, of course, we will have a new problem in the year coming, because as the Arctic ice is melting, then there's a new channel of communication that's opening up in the north between Canada and Russia. And this will have to be securitized, and this will mean that Canada will have to spend more. I'm sure that Canadians will be ready to do that to preserve their own independence. So that's a question to be discussed. I wrote an article about 10 years ago proposing that NATO was a relic of the old Cold War and should be abolished. And if Mr. Trump agrees with that, that would be fine with me, because I think this is NATO is as much a problem now for peace as it is an instrument of peace, especially in Europe, where it has been used to circle around Russia and place missiles launching sites in Poland and many other countries is in an aggressive way. If you want peace, you should not have a policy of aggression. A policy of aggression can cost a lot, because you have to have an arms race, and the social programs within countries suffer as a consequence. Of course, Canada is a health plan for everybody, and we prefer that instead of launching wars. In the U.S., the war party seems to be so strong that they need a war to have a huge defense budget, which creates huge deficits, which create a lot of problem and not enough money left to spend on social programs. This is a political problem within the United States that has to be solved within the United States, and it has to be debated. Do we need that many wars to keep the war industries functioning, or do we need to diversify and put the emphasis on self-defense? I think every country has a right to self-defense.
Well, of course, Donald Trump has promised to increase the defense budget, which is hard to believe, since the U.S. spends more on defense than I think the top 10 other countries in the world combined, and most of them are allies. So, By the way,
half of the military expenses in the world are done by the United States.
Yeah, I know. No,
what the United States is afraid of, there are no other countries as heavily armed as the United States. If it is for self-defense, if it is for aggression, of course you need 100% of military expenditures to conquer the world. But to conquer the world is not a policy that the United States should pursue as a democracy. If they do that, they will have to turn into an empire, and empires are costly and are very dangerous to the freedom of the people and to their standard of living.
Right, and I agree with everything you said, but the point still remains that Donald Trump wants to increase defense spending, as if we don't spend enough already. So that's
the Obama administration wanted to increase the nuclear armament, and Mr. Trump has said a bit the same thing, which is, I think, crazy in this world. We cannot envisage a nuclear war unless we need, we wish the end of humanity. I think we need to think about these things and discuss them more freely, as we did in 1945, when the United Nations were created. Now the United Nations is nearly powerless because the United States goes around the United Nations, use NATO instead. I hope the Secretary of State will look at these things, Mr. Tillerson, and be constructive and prepare the world for the rest of the 21st century. There are many problems that are existential facing this century, and they have not been addressed properly, I think.
Well, just in closing, Prime Minister Trudeau and Donald Trump, President Trump, met in the White House today, and Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, held a roundtable discussion with both leaders, and under the auspices of the United States Canada Council for the Advancement of Women Business Leaders, Female Entrepreneurs, and a group of women executives from both countries were sitting around the table. What did you make of that?
I mean, I think this was a good show. I think if you want to have a meeting that is friendly, that was a good approach. I think I will agree with that. I think we have important women and CEOs in Canada, and they have important. You have important CEOs, women CEOs, like the General Motors chairwoman. I think that was a good approach, but you could raise the importance, the important role that Mr. Trump's daughter plays in the administration. She's supposed not to have an official status in the in the administration. But if he keeps, she plays as an ambassador. I think she should be nominated and confirmed by the Senate.
Right, and of course you have a female foreign minister, Chrystia Freeman, and we basically the Trump cabinet is almost entirely male, with the exception of Betsy DeVos at Education and Elaine Chao, the wife of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the Department of Transportation. So there's a real deficit on the U.S. side in terms of a cabinet full of white men. I thank you for joining us, Rodrigue Tremblay.
Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you. And again, bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Rodrigue Tremblay. He's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and his books include The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by